Welcome to I See What You Mean, a podcast about how people get on the same page or don't, or perhaps shouldn't. Today's episode is special because I'm talking to two colleagues with whom I've recorded separate episodes about a topic they're both passionate about, leadership. Welcome back, Bob Nunnally.
Hi. Hey, Luke. Thanks for the chance to be back.
I'm looking forward to it. Bob is COO of Oasis International Corp, a technology, cyber, and business management SDVOSB. And Bob, our episode will be published tomorrow, November 10th.
Awesome.
Welcome back, Tom Oates.
A pleasure, as always.
Good to see you. Tom is a deputy director of a national clearinghouse for child welfare best practices, and the episode that Tom and I recorded published on September 21st. So, gents, we had great conversations, some of which overlapped thematically. We've worked together and put some of these kinds of the things that we talked about into practice. You are both passionate about leadership. Let's just start there, maybe with some comments about what you think leadership is, with an approach that we talked about in the both interviews, intent-based leadership and commander's intent, which are similar but not identical. And let's start broad, but then I want to get specific so that we dig in a little bit. We can pick up where our previous interviews left off and we can dig into some new material. Bob, you want to start?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks, Lou. Appreciate the chance to get back together and, sure. and be on the show with Tom, too. So one of the things we talked about, I'll bring up two points. One is I find it very important to differentiate between management and leadership.
Right.
First, to me, management is very science-based about, and I joke about it being, do we have enough beans, bullets, and blankets to get the mission done, right? There's logistics, there's just-in-time logistics. There's all kind of concepts for scheduling and different things. And what I need to do when I'm in the senior role is make sure things are managed well so that people can get their jobs done. I differentiate that from leadership, which in my mind is more about how do you get people to do the right things. So they have enough beams, blankets, and bullets, and they can physically accomplish stuff. But are they inspired to do right, especially in the face of either ambiguity,
right,
or doubt, or conflict or challenge,
uncertainty,
right?
Complexity. Yeah,
absolutely. That, in my mind, is the art of leadership, not the science of leadership. And really strong leaders in my life, and I'd offer in the listeners' lives or in y'all's lives, I think we would say, man, that person has been in command of what we were doing. And in my mind, the command part is where they understood that they had a management role and they have a leadership role. And the management role is about making sure my team has enough beans, blankets, and bullets to get stuff done.
Right.
But in that, even in the face of having enough stuff, are they doing the right things? And you have to find that balance, right? So do I need to put on my leadership hat and dive into the leadership of the inspiring greatness out of the team? Or do you need to put on my management hat and go find more beans, blankets, and bullets? And a person who's in command of the situation or the organization seems to have this great ability to say, oh, I need less leadership. They're highly inspired. They need more beans, blankets, and bullets. And so I'm going to be on the management side. Or, hey, they got plenty of stuff. And the leadership, she steps up in there and she grabs command as a leader. And she says, I need to inspire them to greatness. So that's the first part. And then the second part is we talked a little bit about commander's intent, which in my mind is really a manner of how you inspire your team to make great choices, to grow as leaders themselves, as tacticians, as people who can bring operations to life. And I think that ties in probably pretty well with how Tom thinks about intention-based leadership.
Yeah, that's a neat handoff, because it is, you know, the way I kind of view at least my role now is we've hired the right people, right? You hired the people with the skills and expertise to do the work, and they frankly know it better than us, the farther away you get on the org chart. But my job is to make sure that their path to success is clear. That yes, they have the I'm gonna start channeling this as well. The beans, blankets, and bullets. but also that all those barriers are knocked out of the way, because that's what I can do, and let them grow and succeed. But a lot of that is also truly building them, letting them kind of chart their path forward, understanding that the work they're doing today may not be the work they do tomorrow or a year from now. So how can I best pave the way for them to walk the path? And a lot of that is letting them take their current job and making it better, taking their current work and making it better for their client, for themselves, for their teammates. And I think there's an area of freedom that you have to create, because I think in today's work environment, a lot of people walk into their job and deep down, people are still operating out of fear. They're operating out of fear of ticking off the boss or losing their job or fear of making a mistake. And if you can create the environment where that's completely acceptable and we learn from it and we grow from it, then I think you've got that dynamic where the inspiration may come a little bit from the internal that I've got some control, but then it's also, you're not a butt in a seat. You're actually making things change and hopefully making them for the better. And so how do you make that mind shift, moving somebody away from maybe that fear to the freedom?
I have got like 10 things I'm thinking since both of you talked for just 6 minutes, and amazing ideas embedded in here. Let's pick them apart a little bit. Bob, say two things, please, and then we'll start digging in. The responsibilities of a leader, and you mentioned before that commander's intent might have initially been a move in the service to help promote innovation. Did I get that right? And would you comment on that a little bit?
Well, why don't I start with the three values, because I think they're going to tie back to exactly what, or the three responsibilities, they're going to tie back very much to what Tom was just talking about. Mm-hmm. If I hire someone into my organization to be a supervisor, and it doesn't matter whether they're the doc foreman or the assistant COO or what a CFO, whatever it is, I feel that they have three absolute responsibilities to the organization. And that's first to create the vision for the area they work in, right? Because nobody knows the doc as well as the doc foreman. So there ought to be a vision for the doc built by the doc foreman, right?
Right.
The second is develop the culture. And what I mean by that is really inculcating everyone that works with them and for them in the values of the organization, right? Because it's values that drive operations. And so the second responsibility is that you've got to develop that culture. And by culture, I mean the values that we're going to live and breathe as a team. And then the third is to communicate the solutions, right? Which is not just the ability to make a decision, because surely as somebody in a supervisory role, everybody understands they get to make the decision. Is it up, down, left, right, green, red, whatever it is, right? But rather to be able to explain to everyone else why and how I made that decision. And that ties right back to what Tom was talking about in terms of I've got to be able to train them and get them ready to take my place. The other great value that provides for the company is if somebody's explaining how we made that decision or why we made that decision to the group, it lets me reinforce the first one, because we did this because it is perfectly aligned to the vision of the loading dock. And then secondly goes, and because these are the values we hold dear, and that's why this decision is important. Mm. It's tied directly to the values. So if we can make that, it becomes a little bit like a circle, right? Where as I'm communicating things out, I'm reinforcing the first two. So that's the first part on the three values or the three responsibilities that I feel if I hire you, whether you're a doc foreman or the CFO, you have to the organization. The second part then you asked me about was commander's intent. As listeners may recall, I'm just an trusty old fighter pilot. I have a very small brain. Then I have to keep things very simple.
That's inhaled too many exhaust fumes.
way too many exhaust fumes. Commander's intent is something that's drilled into us in the military. And you know, I'll give props to my Army peers, because I think it probably first came through there. But yes, it's very much the concept of commander's intent is I'm not going to tell you what the exact answer is to this. I need you to use your brains and your knowledge at the front lines, whether you're the doc foreman or you're an infantry captain or lieutenant. I need you to use that and empower your innovation So what I'm going to do in Commander's Intent is I'm going to describe for you the purpose of what we're doing, and then I'm going to talk about the conditions that define the end state, right? So I'm not going to tell you load that truck this way. What I'm going to say is by noon, all the trucks need to be loaded.
And on the road,
we
right.
have to right. be able to hit a deadline, and they can only be there if they're on their way by noon. And we will have completed it with no one hurt and everyone and nothing broken or damaged.
Right.
And then what subsequently happens after you give Commander's Intent is you ask, give them some time to plan it, and you say, brief me back. And they'll come back and say, here's our plan. And that's the point at which you get to do two things. One is understand exactly how creative and capable your staff and team are, but also get your chance to coach as a leader. And so back to the three things of the that I talked about, of the responsibilities. Are they meeting the vision for us as an organization? Are they exhibiting the culture and the decision-making and the values that are important? And are they communicating the solutions down to the men and women who are going to have to load the trucks in such a way that everybody at every level of the organization now knows what it is we're trying to accomplish and why?
Thank you, sir. Tom, I know you're...
Let me add to that, because there's another added benefit.
As you do, go ahead and build on to explaining your understanding of intent-based leadership.
Sure. Well, and if you scroll back when you're listening to this, you'll recognize that one of the things he's also doing along the way is he's informing everybody of the reason why and the rationale why. Right. So it's not just I'm just tossing orders and then I'm going to walk away, but he's giving you the full context. Right. And so now somebody has some meaning behind the work. You know, it goes back to why is this so important? Well, he's giving you the objectives and he's giving you the goals and the transparency behind that. And part of that is also trust. So now I'm also bestowing a little bit more trust. I'm being more transparent. And hopefully that's building some it's going to give some benefits in that relationship that I'll have with my staff. But if you'll also listen, one of the things that in the dialogue with, let's say, the dock workers is they haven't turned to the dock foreman or Bob and say, just tell me what to do.
Right.
Because now I've got a little bit more control on how to do it. And so intent-based leadership is really trying to steer away from that. Hey, we got a problem. Please advise, right? Or somebody called and they've asked me something. What should I do? Where you'd like to move somebody along, which is where you pose the right questions of what's the situation? What are our alternatives? You know, what could happen if you let them build that situation, build that solution based on their own skills, knowledge, and expertise, right? And so what I like about what Bob just mentioned is when he comes back and says, now brief me.
Right.
Right? Tell me what you intend to do. And so then instead of the leader walking in, the boss coming in and saying, here's what you're going to do, now do it and walk away, this now becomes here's a solution that we have to have. It's got to have, you know, the box that we're building has to be this big and this wide, and it's got to handle this many pounds, you know? Okay. And now based on that, I want somebody to come back and say, well, I've thought about handles on this box. I've thought about how we're going to pack this or stack
material,
this box.
The process for...
Right. Yeah, somebody starts thinking a little bit differently about how that box is going to be used. They didn't just build a box. And then turning around, and then they tell me what they intend to do. So now you get somebody hopefully thinking at your level, you know, and they're thinking a little farther ahead. So they're going to be prepared for the day I'm not there, or they're going to be prepared to lead their own dock.
And I know
they go down the road.
I know.
So that's where this all comes from, is building that skill set and that innovation within the team, rather than waiting for the team just to be directed in a certain way.
And I know the succession planning or training your replacement is important to both of you. And I know, you know, Bob, makes a ton of sense coming out of, within the service when leadership rotates all the time, right?
Yep.
And so to build, to train the next leader is really vital to a steady operation of that unit, of that vertical, whatever it is. Do you know the story of Tom? It's L. David Marquette, isn't it? Isn't that the author's name?
I believe it's pronounced Marquette or Marquet. Yeah. The story all comes from a book called Turn This Ship Around, which basically is written by a submarine commander. So there is this military backbone between both of what Bob and I are referring to. But long story short, he plans to take over a brand new submarine. And for a year, he studies the crew. He studies the mechanisms. He understands this ship back and forward. Right before he takes over this new ship, the Navy says, "You're awesome. So awesome, you're going to take over that ship." And that's the worst performing sub in the Navy. It's a different ship. It's a different crew. He jumps in, but he's been a captain before. He's turned ships around before. They go out, and he decides to test them out a little bit. Let's say, all right, let's run a little drill here. And then they run the drill as if they lose nuclear power, and now they've got to go on engine power. And so he tells his XO, his next in line, you know, pull the rudder at half power. And the XO gives the command, half power. And the kid behind the wheel stops and practically shaking. He calls the order again, half power. Half power. "Son, did you not hear the order?" "Yes, sir, I did." "Well, why aren't we at half power?" "Sir, there is no half power." "Because on this boat, it's 1/4 or 3/4. And so he realizes at that point, I don't know this ship, and everybody is going to do exactly what I say. So he instantly, he gets the image in his mind that we're going to take this submarine into a crater, because now everybody's going to be relying on me, and I'm the least informed person. And so he then turns around and realizes that the value of his ship are the staff and the experience of that crew. So he has to turn that kind of, he turns the culture around.
Yeah, he did.
By really, and I don't want to use the word empower, because it still sounds like the power is within the leader. You know, like I have the power of the king, and I just touch you on the shoulder, and now magically you have the power. Really what it is, it's a form of emancipation, of somebody has that freedom to then turn around and say, all right, I intend to plot this course. I intend to go at this speed. As the team works together to kind of double check each other, then he's not telling folks what to do anymore. But he's just, again, he's getting briefed.
Let me add on to that, Tom. Bob is very short and very funny, probably a TED Talk video on Intent-Based Leadership's website. You could listen to it in 6 or 8 minutes. And it gives you the whole concept. What he did, as Tom described, the ship was coming up for inspection, and he said to his leadership team, what are we going to do? And he said, they talked amongst themselves, and they said, we have an idea. You should shut up. And he said, but captains don't shut up.
Then
he said he thought about it, and he knew they were right. So he let them lead the inspection. But what he said he realized was, what he decided was, except for the order to fire a weapon, he was not going to give a command. He reserved that one to himself, and he said, I'm only going to ask questions. And he began to ask everybody who spoke to him. This is like Tom saying people come to him. He said, he would ask them, well, what do you think? Where do you think we should go? Why? And it was always a combination of what and why, Bob. It was very much the commander's intent concept. What should we do? Why that? And he said in a day, I remember hearing him say, Tom, in 24 hours, he saw a different conversation going on around him, not with just with him, but amongst others. And he said in some number of months, maybe 3 months or 6 months, the whole culture of the place had changed, because they had those conversations with each other, which was a really cool part. You're at the top, and only so many people get to you with a conversation. They had those conversations throughout this submarine that way.
Right. Well, I tell you, there's a couple of things in that whole approach that I think are tremendously important for leaders of all level or all experience levels to take into consideration and think about. When we appoint someone or we select someone, or we hire someone into a leadership position, right? There is an inherent assumption by both the people being led and by the leader, him or herself, that says, well, I'm ready for this. When in actuality, that may not be the case, right? Because very few selection processes are so finely tuned and accurate. What they've really selected is probably the right person for the potential to lead that level. right? Because they've demonstrated some success. They've demonstrated, right. you know, creativity, whatever it is, you know, he or she is doing great and great person. But when they get into the leadership position, it may be more than they thought of or more complex, or in that particular example, not the same boat. So it's right. a little different, right? So what that reminds me of is something that I think is really important to coach in terms of the culture and organization. And I know Tom does this. I know you do that too. Is that, but the mantra I use is none of us is as good as all of us together. Right.
Right.
And so the question then becomes, but how do I make us all of us together?
Right.
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 Because I just got selected for the position. They all think I'm in charge. they think I know what I'm doing. I may think I know what I'm doing until the moment I don't. I believe like I'm doing the imposter thing. And so now in this particular case, an example was the leader taking a second going like, okay, well, got it. We're not all of us together right now. Right. And so maybe I am the impediment in having the courage to go like, you know what, here's what we're going to do. That's pretty strong statement on individual leadership. Because yeah. again, one of the fallacies or foibles we have as leaders is we don't want to be embarrassed. And you know, we got selected for this job. And so I got to get it right. Well, maybe what we got to do is get us all on the same sheet of paper and on the same describing things and defining things the same way to create all of us together. None of us is as good as all of us together.
But that's a great principle, but you asked the million-dollar question, which is, okay, then how do I get us together? And let's dig into how you, both of you, have applied some of these principles and practices. I want to get it down to the level of a conversation, where you were in a conversation with an individual on a one-to-one basis or with a team, and you applied any one of these practices or principles, and how it went, what you learned, did it go the way you thought it would, and did you make an adjustment? How does this work in practice when you're having a conversation with people?
I think one of the things you have to realize, especially now, that many times leaders are put in their leadership position without true insight into what their teams are doing or capable of, especially in this knowledge economy. If you are in charge of, let's say, the dock workers, maybe you worked on a dock yourself, or maybe you didn't. Maybe you come from logistics or shipping, and now you're in charge of the dock, and you've never loaded, you know, a ship in your life. You still, like Bob mentioned, as the leader, you think you know, or you think you're the one in charge, or you feel like you have to
you're
have
supposed
the right
to know.
Answer.
Yeah, right.
Right? I think so. Let's just take the situation of, you know, client has an immediate need and the issue is at hand.
Well, Tom, let me say this. You run a national program. Yeah. So you have a team of about 90 who are responsible for interaction with all 50 states, right?
With a federal organization, and they reach out to all 50 states.
Okay, right. Okay.
So, but that being said, you could have one organization doesn't mean one thought, because there's plenty of people within, you know.
Well, and my thought was, along the lines of what you were saying, was you're the deputy director. You can't possibly know what all those customers need. I mean, through the program.
You're exactly right, because we have multiple, you know, there's writers, there are IT folks, there is a shipping department, and all the different facets of an org chart that looks like, you know, a game of Tetris gone bad. So what you find is you use the intelligence of the team. So this was something somebody else said earlier, but the first thing I do is I shut up. You bring everybody together and you state, just like Bob had mentioned, all right, we've got a deadline. It's got to be, it's got to do this, this, and this, and it's got to be done by this. And then I step back, because the last thing, and a lot of times this happens when we're urgent, when we're trying to get things done, is the boss walks in there and they drop a solution on the table and right. say, let's do this. And all that does is tell everybody else that your idea can move to the side. Everything is now, let's just talk about Tom's idea. And Tom's idea may be okay, but if Tom shut up and let the group now build upon each other, A, it starts getting everybody on the same page. They may have to fight it out a little bit, but especially when one person has an idea and then they build on it, and then they build on it. And, oh, we could also do this, and I can do this, and I can do that. Then the solution that they build together as a team normally is 10 times better than anything Tom thought of. And they build it together. They empower it. They've grown it. They've innovated it, and it's theirs.
They own it, yeah. There's an investment.
And then they realize during all this time they really didn't need me anyway. And that's kind of my goal.
You could have input to it. You could clear things out of their way. You've got a role in it. But I appreciate what you're saying.
But and the role really is to ask questions. The role is, have we thought about, you know, this, or what's the impact, or how do we communicate this, or
what could go wrong?
Or my favorite question is, what am I missing?
Right, right.
Because that just lets them, it gives them the blank check to call me out on my ideas and to build upon it.
Bob, you've been vigorously taking notes on Tom's.
I have been because I every time, and this is the beauty of having worked with Tom sometimes too, is just like going, oh, yeah. And then, so some of it's for my own personal use later, but also some of the conversation we're having. I think there's a couple of things that are really important here that and I'll put something for a second. You know, I'm supposed to know the answer. I'm in charge. No, what you're supposed to do is to have the best possible outcome come out of the group I'm leading without any preconceived notion of how it generally happens. Now, I would hope that I'm good enough to know that we're on the right track, but I may not.
Right, right.
I might be in charge of something that's totally new, and this is not unusual in the military, right? In the middle of the night, I was told to show up at the commander's office one morning at 8 o'clock. I showed up. He said, congratulations, you're the headquarters squadron commander. And he goes, do you have any questions? I go, what's a headquarters squadron? I don't know. And he goes, like, you'll figure it out. Here's your office. I go, oh, okay. So that morning, I took over 300 people in 6 facilities on the base, and I didn't even know what they did, right?
Yeah, right.
So it's truly one of the most important elements of the whole leadership conversation we've had is the humility, the comfort with your own humility to go, I don't know the answer, but I bet I know how to get it. And this is one of the things that trips me up sometimes with new leaders who are stepping into a position is, you know, you're fired up because you got selected. You were amongst your peers, and now you're first amongst your peers, and you're in charge, and this is your first supervisory job. And so you're ready to roll. You must know everything.
Yeah.
Really, what I think we need to encourage all of our young leaders as they step out there to know is 2 things. One is, I want you to trust your gut, because if I've trained you well, your gut is going to tell you that you think this is kind of about right.
Or not.
But don't think you, or not, and don't think you actually know the answer.
Right.
There's some seasoned person who's been on the dock for 45 years. They probably know the answer.
Yeah.
So your task is, can I find that person, and I can convince them to speak up, because they may not be personally wired to speak up amongst all their peers.
Well, I like Tom's phrase, use the intelligence of the team.
Absolutely. And so that's back to the part of, like, none of us as good as all of us together. When I step in, one of my first assessments of a new role is, like, how much of an all of us is there? Or is, and we talked about this once before, half of my career was fixing failing organizations. And so I stepped into a whole lot of organizations that were not operating well,
right,
and needed to operate really well within the next hour, right?
Yeah.
And so being able to go in and say, gosh, okay, so how can I get this thing back on the track is good. But the second thing for our young leaders is to understand asking for help is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. And the reason for that is, and again, back to being a small-brained fighter pilot kind of guy, when I yell Mayday, Mayday on the radio, it's not that it's a failure or a weakness. It's that I have faith in you as you hear me yell for that help that you can and will help me. And so it's a sign of strength to say Mayday. It's not a sign of weakness. And so I want that young leader, when he or she steps out there, to go, like, okay, all right, I'm not the smartest. This is my first day on the job as a dock foreman. Like, tell me about yourself. How long have you been doing this? How many checks have you done? I mean, to go find those people, right?
Well, okay, but you two are coming from a place of some fairly enlightened leadership thinking. That's to separate, you know, a real old school, I'll tell you what to do, when to do it, how to do it, right? We're far past that. I like your point about young leaders, though, Bob, because they're kind of they're in transition. The day before they were a leader, they were one of the team, and now they're a leader, and the world changed in some ways, and this part of what you're saying is there's a mentoring of them that you have to prepare them for some things that probably not what they think they had to be prepared for either. It's more personal things that they didn't see coming, like you're talking about. But I want to point out, I think most team members, non-leaders, worker bees, might still have the old school mentality that they look up a chain of command at a first level supervisor and higher, and think that the answers are there, the decisions are there, the knowledge is there, the experience, something is there, and which still fosters that, tell me what to do. So tell me how you guys have worked to change that mindset, because you're talking about changing their mind. You've got the mindset already. You're not the old school style of leader. You're an enlightened leader. You know what your job is. The three leadership responsibilities Bob mentioned, getting the most out of a team. You're talking about succession planning, growing people. You're responsible for the right outcome. Okay. How do you start to turn two to hundreds of people around who might think that I do a piece and I do that piece, but if I'm going to do a different piece, someone should tell me, right? They got that mindset. Right. How have you started to change that?
So make sure I'm understanding, because I'm thinking down two paths here. One is a young leader who feels like they have to give the orders.
Okay.
And the second is a member of the team who feels they have to be ordered.
There you go. Okay. Well right? said.
So I'll toss to Tom. You can talk in just a second about the what you've seen and how you approach someone who feels they have to be ordered, because I think that is very much along the lines of IBL, right? For the young leader who feels like, gosh, I'm supposed to go in and bark the orders, right? This is a little bit.
He chuckles.
Out there a little bit. Yeah, a little bit out there. Is that I like having the conversation with a new leader that says, okay, what's the first thing you're going to do?
Okay.
Right? And like, you're going to be in charge. So what's the first thing you're going to do? You know, and I sometimes get some great answers, and sometimes I get like, oh, really? That's the first thing? one of the stories I tell them is from my life in the military, is that you don't order someone to give the ultimate sacrifice of their life. That's not how it happens. So there's very little I can order people to do. Now, the exceptions are if I'm in an emergency room and it needs triage right now, then I can put that hat on and bark orders with the best of them. Mm-hmm. Trust me. Mm-hmm. I know how to do that. Mm-hmm. And I feel comfortable doing it if that's the situation. And what I tell them is there will be situations where because of safety or security or finances need or somebody's life isn't, you may actually have to put on, as my wife calls it, the colonel's hat and start barking orders, right?
Right.
But that's not how to lead. That's how to solve a small situation that's very narrow in scope. That's not how it's going to be. What's going to really happen is how are you going to inspire everyone else to do the right thing? Back to our management versus leadership kind of conversation.
Yeah.
How am I going to inspire them? And inspire is one of my favorite words in the world, right? It's Latin from inspirare, which means to breathe life into.
Ah.
So what I ask them is, how are you going to breathe life into everything your team has to do? And I'm pretty sure it's not by barking at them, right? Or telling them, you know, that they're going to take your way. Instead, it's going to take a whole lot more soft skills and some of the things we've been talking about, which is, I'll pitch to my friend Tom, kind of what it's all about you're talking about, right?
So let me, before you transition, so Bob, just stay on that one more moment with the young leader. I'll tell you what, I love the idea of even defining the Latin word, meaning of the word, because when you use a phrase like that, breathe life into it, it just makes you think about something you thought you knew. So differently, you go, whoa, that's what it means to inspire? Now you're recalculating the calculus you had made before, and that's a good personal challenge. Now you're challenging yourself. If you've asked them what's the first thing you're going to do, the response came back to you, suggested to you, they weren't thinking about it in the way you'd like them to start thinking about it right away. Now, you could let them go make the first misstep, and then you could debrief that and course correct. But how have you said, okay, let's think about this, or let's rethink this, or what have you done in situations?
Well, the one tool I use is something I call the top 10. I go, what are the first 10 questions you're going to ask your team about?
All right.
And they go like, well, why would I ask them questions? I'm like, okay, I've obviously picked the wrong person. No, right. No, but I start saying, and I go, because there's some other dynamics when the new leader is put in place. One of the dynamics I've learned about in life is a few of the malcontents in the organization will come forward because they didn't get the answer they wanted from the previous leader. So they're going to be the first people at your door. And if you're not smart enough to know that, what's going to happen is you're like going, well, Sam here brought me this great idea about, like, you know, replacing the water fountains with Coca-Cola fountains. I go, like, okay, yeah, no. There's a reason that wasn't approved, because there's a good chance your predecessor was not goofy, right? And so the first people that come to your desk typically when you're the new leader are the people who didn't get the answer they wanted from the previous leader. Now, some of them, you know, you might be replacing a leader who was really bad, a bad apple, and so great ideas got squashed. I haven't found that to be the case that often. So what I do is say, what are the first 10 questions you're going to ask your organization, and where do you think you'll find that answer? And then I want you to come back and talk to me, like 2 days, 3 days a week, whatever it is, about that. If I have been involved in that organization, I'll tell them, I'll say, here's about 4 things I'm thinking about the organization. If you could validate those for me, that would be great. Let's have that conversation, right? Because if I'm that leader of that organization, and I just hired a replacement, then I probably know something
they don't know
about the leaders,
yes.
Right? And so I want to kind of coach them through that opening period, right? So that's kind of just a couple of techniques.
Thank you. Over to you, Tom.
Wow.
I need to tell me what to do. I like how Bob said it. Give orders or take orders.
Yeah, right. For when you're trying to really change the culture of that boss staff relationship, I think one of the biggest things that you need to do is try to knock the fear out of it and knock the power dynamics out of it. Because as a leader, I should be judged by the success or failures of my team.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Right. And so here's something that I actually do with my direct reports, and some of them actually lead teams of their own. But right when we do our first kickoff, it's like, you know, a new boss coming in, or they're now reporting to me. And it's just kind of what I call a setting expectations meeting. And I don't think that's a surprise to anybody who set the expectations of what. But the first slide is what they should expect out of me. And what I'm trying to do is explain to them that my first priority is their ability to do their job, right? Knocking out all those barriers. But I explain to them a few things, that they should always expect me to be responsive to them. That, you know, their inquiries, their questions, you know, are always going to be first on my list. So I will always respond to their question. May not be with the answer they want. That leads me up to, you know, my job. I may not always have the answer, but I'm going to do my best to figure it out. Let's go find it. Let's go find whatever that is. They should also expect me to ask questions and be curious of them.
Okay.
I start to open up the door. Listen, I understand I don't know your job. So you need to expect me to come from an area of curiosity. Because my questions aren't going to be gotcha questions.
Right.
Did you do this? Did you not do that? Because I'm really... You know, because I don't know. So my curiosity is going to be the lead. And then that next slide is my expectations of them. And they're the exact same thing. That I expect them to be curious of me, to be just responsive, to maybe not have the answer, but to figure it out for their teams. And also one of the things I always stress is I will trust them, or I will expect them to be the expert. That I'm going to come to you as the expert in what you do. And I expect you to be able to come to me as the expert. So you knock down, hopefully, those walls of fear of judgment or the gotcha idea of that boss.
Mm-hmm.
And you set this expectation of, I'm going to come at you to support you, to be curious about what you do, to find out what you need and find out what I'm missing. To be able to go and have those teams do bigger, better, more innovative things. But I think it's important still to actually document it, to say it, to make it clear, to put it in writing, so to speak.
Right.
And while we think we operate under that understanding,
No.
It's very important to make it clear,
no.
No matter how seasoned somebody is, just to be able to say, listen, I am your representative up the chain versus like upper management, representative down
the chain. It's much more likely that they expect you to come in and do a real conventional thing of tell them how you're going to, where you're going to take things and how and not that you don't have a vision, not that you wouldn't, but when you, if the first thing you do is a role definition, and then you very cleverly, it's a really brilliant move to define the roles with the same content of the two slides, it says, this is a different, perhaps a different power relationship, which leads to perhaps different conversations. And I know that you have had different conversations because we've talked about them, but I'm just pointing out before we get to that, if you open up that way on a first day, it not only sets a tone, it probably challenges them to rethink the assumptions they went in with, which might have been pretty conventional.
Even things like, I expect you to come and vent to me. It's we're still at that level where I think you need to open the doors and, you know, give somebody that blank check to treat the relationship as special, not transactional, and nowhere near, you know, the boss telling you what to do.
Right. Or recrimination. There's nothing worse than all the conversations going on in the organization and you're not a part of them. You're shielded, you're kept, right? Then there's valuable information being exchanged by people, then you're not a part of it. And that's what you don't want.
Yeah. Or even worse, if they don't bring their problems
anymore. Right.
And that's, well, I mean, the third member of this conversation was the one who said it to me, and he quoted it from a book. But I mean, if your teams aren't bringing you their problems to you,
you own them.
that's either because they don't think you can help them, or they don't think you want to.
Yeah, right.
And either way is failed.
It's bad. Yeah.
We have to give credit for that one to our recently departed Colin Powell. Yep. In his book, it's a great leadership read of My American Journey. The minute soldiers stop bringing you their problems, it's because they've decided you don't care or you can't fix them.
And the irony is, well, that's a horrible situation. And the irony is the problems get worse and you own them. And when they come down on you, there's no preventing them. It's now you have to recover from them, and now you've also damaged relationships, which is the worst thing, because any technical problem can be solved. Relationships, any trust relationship, is harder to rebuild. Would you have any other thoughts on that, Bob? Then I'm gonna ask us one sort of closeout question.
No, go ahead.
Bob, you made the comment in our episode that there's always more to the story, and I laugh because it's plain language thought there, but so profound. There is always more to the story, especially if it's just even a reasonably complex project, different people with different skill sets, knowledge areas, points of view on a project, a client with a challenging project, a problem that might vary across regionally or across the country, or vary for different of their customer segments, right? There's always more going on than you know, and one of the challenges of the leader is to know what he or she doesn't know. So tell me a time when it was demonstrated to you there's always more to the story, when two or more parties thought they were on the same page, but they did understand a concept, a notion, a something differently.
Yeah, so I'll replay one in that's very happening in almost real time of our podcast here. we're working with a client, and we think we are talking about their specific problem and exactly what they wanted us to solve. And so we've gone to a lot of trouble to come up with a solution, build a presentation, and brief it, only to find out that we didn't ask enough questions. And so the client's receiving the presentation, and they're like, and they're very polite, which is fantastic, right? And they go, wow, that was great information. But our actual problem is when we said we didn't know how to use a Jira instance, which is a tool used for Agile stuff, they go, what we meant was, we don't actually have a Jira instance. And so how could we buy one? And we were explaining all the different ways you could use one.
It,
and what they really just needed was to buy one, right? Like, where do we buy it? And so I'm kind of like, oh, well, that's easy. We'll bring one tomorrow morning. We're done, right? And so but the lesson learned for our team is one that's timeless for all of us in leadership positions.
Yes, yes.
Is have we defined something in a common way? Are we using the same vernacular? When you use the word orange, right? And I say I ate an orange. It's really clear to probably 90%, at least most English speaking folks,
right, right.
That okay, exactly what I'm talking about. But if I said I had fruit for lunch, you don't know if it was an orange or a kumquat or a banana or a dragon fruit. You don't know what it was, right? So our ability to ask enough questions, the follow-up would be like, well, what specific fruit did you have, right? Right?
Yeah.
But there's a natural impediment in the leadership chain to that. And that is, if I'm having that conversation with my staff, they don't want to look silly in front of me. And so they're afraid that they're going, if they ask me a question. So the one thing that worries me absolutely the most as a leader is when I think I've given fairly clear instruction and I go, you got it. And they have no questions. Because I think I'm an okay communicator.
I'm not that good.
And so that's when I start to go like, huh, there are lots of impediments to communication. I could be one. And so the brief back concept, tying this all the way back to. I like too. It's like, okay, so tell me what you think this is about.
Yeah.
Tell me what the first three things are you're going to do. And if I get the like, well, I'm like, oh man, we're not close to the same page.
I love that. Tom, go ahead. I
sure. I think in similar vein, it's when everybody is on the same page, but the language is different to everybody. Right.
Right.
And so I think one of the dangers, though, becomes like the value or the overvalue that we place on our own intelligence or what we think we are. Right. It's your own confidence. And it leads me back to a phrase that I've used for years of, are you right or are you sure? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of gets to where Bob's talking about, like, let's ask about that piece of fruit that you ate. Let's just confirm it. Because a lot of times I don't think we're always confirming something.
Right.
It's, you know, hey, well, so-and-so thinks that we've got to go stick with this software and this is how we have to use it because it was written down in what we proposed. And and by golly, this is our driver.
Yeah.
Well, is that our driver or is our driver the big picture mission and the outcomes that we're going for?
Right.
So which one is it? Well, it's this one. Well, are you right or are you sure? Well, I'm sure I'm right. And, you know, those are the things we tell ourselves where it's one of those things of, well, ask the second question. And there's an old journalism axiom that says, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. Right. So like, just validate the source. Right. Check. Just double check.
Oh, that's right. I love it.
It doesn't hurt to follow up because if you get it right, awesome. But if you were sure,
then you were wrong. Shame on you.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
No, that's beautiful. There's a great practices. Confirm. What would you call it, Tom? You know, you
validate.
Validate. Right. Call for your mom's friends and say.
Yeah.
Does she talk about me?
Exactly.
I asked my brother, but I'm not sure. Yeah, we gotta
consider the source. Bob, your brief back questions. I tried to jot them down. I think I missed one, but you said the second one I heard you say was tell me the first three things you're going to do. But there was one I missed. Tell me what you heard, or tell me what.
Well, I often tie it back to intent and go like, what's the purpose of this? What's the intent?
Oh, that's. Boy, so that's powerful because now if you're talking to me, I have to tell you what I think, what is the intent and why. Now, if I say that in words that resonate with you, then you know we're on the same page about that.
Right.
If I say it in words that differ from what you meant, that might not be a bad thing. That could be good information in there to schmooze, you know, but we know that we're seeing something a little bit differently. We want to be sure we don't march off and do two different things.
Well, and third element of that, and I use it sometimes, it kind of depends. I usually don't have to get that far, is what does success look like? Because, and Tom's heard me talk about that before too. Like, what's a home run out of this meeting, or what's the home run out of this call or whatever. And everybody goes like, oh, you know, the client buys the thing or, or the boss approves our program or whatever it happens to be. Okay, great, right. That's in under commander's intent. One of the important parts there is to be able to talk about the definition of the end state, like what does it look like, right? So that's kind of loosely tied to those things. I don't have to get into that too often if I can ask the first question that says, like, so what's the purpose of what we're doing? Right. Oh, we're supposed to get the trucks loaded by noon.
What that does, though, also is it creates the relationship of that transparency, right? Now you understand what I understand, and I understand what you understand. So we're operating in this the same level. And at times, somebody else may have heard something else that adds to it. And either that can augment this of, oh, you're right.
Augment is a good word, yeah.
Or if somebody turns and said, yeah, and they also want – they also, you know, they want their logo on the space shuttle.
Well,
and that gives you an opportunity to say yes, but let me give you some context to
noon.
Why. But, and so it becomes a teaching moment as well, and that just strengthens that, you know, staff relationship.
Sure, it does.
That you have.
A good point about augment, Tom, because somebody could come back and say, load the trucks by noon, but no injuries. You could load the trucks by noon and knock someone off the dock because you're rushing. You could and no damaged material. That's important because that was part of the measure of success too.
Right.
So
right.
What that means, Tom, to me, I liked your use of the word augment. If two guys chimed in with that, not just load, but load safely, load carefully, it could be 11:15 and you're not going to make it. So someone's got to have the conversation about trade-offs. Well, we don't want to hurt anybody and we don't want to damage their product that we're shipping to them. So can we get more guys? If we got more guys, do we crowd the dock too much? You can only get so many guys on a dock and in a truck, right? Can we get another forklift? If we got two forklifts, can we get them in and out of there? Right. You start to have a different conversation, which is the problem solving conversation you hope that they would have anyway, right?
Empowering innovation, right? That I could go tell you exactly how to do this thing. And then grade you on exactly how well you followed
my
orders.
Yeah.
And then when I die, you may or may not know anything.
Yeah. Well, that's Tom's point too
Yep. That's exactly why the two concepts are related. Can I build my successor? Can I coach them? Can I train them? Can I create it?
You know, I think the thought to me of what that conversation would sound like amongst a team who was empowered to figure out how, right, get creative, innovate, and understood from the commander's point of view, the lead's point of view, the doc foreman, the CEO, the COO, the whoever it was. Hey, look, this is what they need and why. You share so much information that's so different than do this way. You engage people at such a different level. That's the stuff that changes cultures. Yeah, little moves like that start to change conversations, start to change interactions. Maybe change relationships. That's how you change a culture, I think.
Yeah, I did, and as we've all spoken about in different kind of settings, is it's really the ability to have that culture that carries the day, right? It's the old adage of culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? Is absolutely true. When you as Tom created a high performing team, and you point them in the right direction. Wind them up and let them go, man. It's a beautiful thing to watch.
And part of that is when you're that open, it's any relationship. The more open and the more trust I give in you and you give in me, the less adversarial we're going to be. Mm. And I think with a supervisor and their staff and a leader and their teams, man, if you've got adversarial relationships at that point, even the unsaid ones, right?
Yeah, right.
Just tell me what to do, or I'm going to be dictated to because the boss says so. You're on the wrong foot.
Well, and the things we're talking about, we'll close with this thought and I'm going to get your closing thoughts. But my thought is the things we're talking about are, I want to say the word in my mind is self-reinforcing. That might not be exactly true. I mean, when people interact the way we're talking about interacting, it is strongly positively reinforcing. It usually feels good. It's just a pleasant interaction. It's productive. It's constructive. You're working like a team. You feel that energy. And there's no reason to want less of it. In my experience, people want more of it. And then they create it. Like, you couldn't stop this now if you tried. And you shouldn't try. But if you're like, come Monday. No, and I've been reading some books over the weekend. I want to do a different management approach. I'm going to go old school. They got to a great place. Really on their own. You fostered it, but they got there because they did the work together. And that's where you want them, and they want to be there. That's positive. Closing thoughts, gentlemen?
Well, I'd just like to say thanks. It's been a great chance to tag back up with you guys and to talk about things that we're all passionate about. My encouragement to the listeners would be to find those chances in your own life or in those you supervise to grow your replacement. The number one responsibility of leader is to grow the next leaders, because we're in the position to do it. We're in the position to, you know, to teach, to coach, to give them some responsibility, to let them fail, but to fail smart and have them ready to take our place. Because one of these days we're going to all want to be on a beach with a fruity drink, yeah. Right? And somebody's got to run the ship.
And the organization and mission needs the continuity.
It needs to keep going, man. It's a train ride. We're going to get off the train, but the train ain't stopping. So we've got our responsibility, our commitment to the individuals who work for us is to strive to invest in them and finding those people that can who can take on the next step and lead.
I love the suggestion, Bob. Tom, you're next. Bob, do you have a book recommendation?
Yeah, well, I will go back because it's been in print for quite some time. And again, kind of topical because of his recent passing, is I did have a chance to meet General Powell several times, and actually 2 years ago was an escort for him at a big speaking engagement. There's a lot to be learned from the multitude of lessons that he has in my American journey. So, again, a little bit older book, and it's, you know, a bit biographical.
Timeless. So.
Autobiographical, but certainly to be able to see how someone navigates decision-making is pretty interesting.
I went through two highlighters on that book. No joke. And I can flip through it at any point and go to something I highlighted, and there's relevance. But Lou, just to close it up, people appreciate with value over time. You know, machines and equipment depreciate, and I think the more you feed that with transparency, with trusting somebody to be the expert and to learn and to grow. You talked about positive reinforcement. Negative reinforcement comes from the outside. Positive reinforcement a lot of times comes from the inside. People feel good about what they're doing. They want to do more, right? The somebody who sticks around late because they just want to knock that thing out, they're doing that on their own volition.
An internal motivation. Yeah.
If they're made to stay, negative reinforcement. So it's one of those things of create the freedom for somebody to grow. And I think that's just where you just like you treat them as the experts and you know the brilliant folks that you hired them for.
Inspire
and let them grow from that. Yeah.
Breathe life into.
Yeah. Yeah. It does. You hear that the way Bob described it. You hear that and you instantly take a breath in and you're like, wow, imagine somebody just pumping in oxygen into you and you just sit up like in your chair and think, right. Really,
yeah,
you know?
Come alive. So. All right, gentlemen, what a ball.
Thanks, Lou.
Thank you so much for your time and your thoughts and all the experience that of your careers that you brought to the conversation. I think there's some great things in here for listeners and leaders listeners who are becoming leaders. Thanks, gents.
Thanks, Lou.
Always.
Appreciate it.
Thanks,
all right.
Thanks,
take
Tom.
Care. Bye-bye. And that's how we see it, my friends. I want to thank Bob Nunley and Tom Oates for recording today's episode. You can find it at iseewhatyoumean.castos.com, plus all the usual places. Subscribe and give me a 5-star rating, unless you can't, in which case, tell me why. And join me next week, where we take another look at how to get on the same page and stay there, unless we shouldn't.